Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Helen Fitzgerald on her latest novel, Viral, and then a repeat of our recent interview with Francesca Kay about her latest novel, The Long Room.
Helen Fitzgerald is a best-selling author of Dead Lovely and 9 other adult and young adult thrillers, including My Last Confession, The Donor, and most recently The Cry, which was longlisted for the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year. Helen has worked as a criminal justice social worker for over 10 years. Now based in Scotland, she grew up in Victoria, Australia, as one of 13 children. And her latest novel is Viral, which we're going to be talking about in the main today. Helen, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I don't normally do that last bit in these little blurbs, because I normally like to talk about the work. But I was one of 5 children, and that was bad enough, so I can't avoid asking you about growing up with 13.
It's funny, because I didn't think it was weird until I became an author. And then that's the headline, Helen Fitzgerald is one of 13 children. And I realised, oh yeah, that's kind of strange. What I think the impact it had on me is I do everything really, really fast. I eat really fast. I run really fast. I have a huge sort of self-survival instinct. I remember once when my dad used to take us on holidays, and looking back, I think, how on earth did you do that with all these children in a caravan? And we're driving through the sort of desert in Australia, and I'm sitting in the back, and the caravan, we've got the big caravan, the huge car. Dad had sort of made, he was an engineer, and he used to do all these inventions and things to make us fit into places. So I think I was effectively in the boot. And we're driving along in the middle of nowhere, and the car starts sort of smoking. It's going to blow up. So Dad pulls over, stops the car, turns the engine off, and then someone says, "Where's Hallie?" And I'd already jumped over a fence and was about 2 fields away. So I think, you know, being one of such a big family just made me look after myself pretty selfishly for a long time, actually. But mostly we always just were guaranteed to have good parties. So my 21st, I knew I at least had 26 people.
Like, yeah, you've not got to bother inviting anybody else, really. Yeah. So what about your writing? Has that impacted on you becoming a writer in any way?
Well, I don't know. My mum was a literature teacher. I should say my mum didn't give birth to 13 children. She would say, "Please don't make it out of here. That would be just weird. I didn't do that." My dad had 8 children under the age of 12 when his wife died, and my mum married him, and then they had another 5. And at the time, they were very sort of strict Catholics. About 20 years later or 30 years later, they both became kind of atheists. Such a shame.
They finally discovered the joys of contraception by that point.
I know, crazy. So I don't know whether it affected my writing. What did mostly probably did. I'm always writing about family dynamics, actually. I haven't thought about it. But every single book, my number one before I can sit down to write is, have I got an interesting family problem, family dynamic, something different going on that's going to drive a novel all the way to the end. So in that way, and also because my mum was such a lover of words and language and such a prolific writer herself, she'd always wanted to be a novelist, but married a widower with 8 children, so never got around to it. So she's been an incredibly big influence on me in terms of writing.
And there's a family dynamic central to this novel, which we'll get onto later on. Let's start with Viral. What's it about? What's the incident that kicks off the story?
Well, the incident is I started writing it when my daughter was going on holiday for school leavers trip to Magaluf with a bunch of friends, and I thought, great, I'm not going to stop her going on holiday. And I didn't really know anything about Magaluf, and she goes off, and I started Googling it, and started parental panic kind of set in. Obviously, there's a lot of stories that have come out of mm-hmm. Magaluf, a lot of behaviour that has really ruined girls and women's lives. It is mainly women and girls. Mm-hmm. So it's about a girl who goes to Magaluf and ends up performing a sex act in a bar when she's completely off her face. Somebody in the crowd films it, uploads it. It completely ruins her life. Mm-hmm. She was about to head off to medical school. Her mother is a sheriff in Scotland that's a judge. And her mother being a very... Well, she's used to law enforcement being clear and simple, mm-hmm. that there's a crime, yes, that you committed it, and here is the punishment. With something like this, which is, has ruined, the family's lives are in tatters after it. There is no crime that, it's not even revenge pornography, it's, mm-hmm. it's involuntary pornography. Somebody is, she's done this in public, so therefore has no right to privacy. It's overseas. The person who's filmed it hasn't, as far as we know, done it for revenge or with intent to cause harm, which is what the law, which is now in place.
Yeah, so this is a new thing, isn't it? Revenge porn particularly is something that now is against the law.
Yeah, 2015 in April in England and Wales it came in, so now it's illegal to publish without consent intimate, explicit photos if it's intended to cause distress to the person. And that hopefully is going to come in to Scotland as well, but at the moment there's no law like that in Scotland. And as I said, with the step further away, involuntary, legally there's nothing you can do.
And that's an interesting distinction, though, because this... And you mentioned, Googling about Magaluf, and a couple of years ago there was this very incident, somebody, like a viral video of a young woman in a nightclub. And clearly posting that video is... I mean, it can't do anything but cause distress if it's not something that's, pornography made for commercial purposes with the full consent of everybody involved. Mm. Even if, as in this case... Sue, the character, nominally gives consent to it happening, even though she's obviously, under the influence.
Absolutely. I mean, what else would it do? And, the other thing is when it's overseas, that it makes that bit more difficult as well. But I've had really interesting discussions with lawyers, defence lawyer, prosecution lawyers, talking about this as to whether you could actually prosecute someone for doing that. And there would be arguments that you could make, but I think it would be pretty unlikely that you'd win.
Obviously, the thing that propagates this, the video goes online and then it's shared via social media. And social media is actually something that's become a bit of a preoccupation of yours. So the last couple of novels have featured incidents on social media. So I suppose let's talk about social media's impact on this sort of thing. I mean, if this had been, 10 years ago, it wouldn't have had such an impact.
Yeah, that's right. I was thinking about myself, when I was her age, actually younger. And I remember I had this sort of brief fling with a boy, and he then told all his friends that we had had sex by the lake, which we hadn't. I was really young. And I grew up in the town, which was had a big boys' boarding school then. Mm-hmm. It was already horrific for girls living there, walking. You felt bullied and there are misogynists all around you all the time. But, for ages I got sort of chanted at, Fitzgerald is a slut. It was horrendous, but that's where it stopped, But if that had happened, or if something was, had happened with me and him, his phone would have been there, who knows what he might have done. And to think that that could still be around, as well, after all those years. I mean, this never goes away.
I mean, also it goes from the village to the global village, obviously. Suddenly anybody anywhere can see this thing. And of course, I mean, the incident in this book involves Sue and, there were 13 people involved in this incident. Of course, the person who invokes the fury of the internet is only one of those people.
Yeah, the woman, you mean. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's I really enjoyed writing the mother's character, Ruth. Yeah. She's about 50. I think she's 52. As I said, she's a sheriff. She's a, she's a strong woman, a feminist, I suppose. And goes on the rampage about everyone else involved because, you've got these other 12 guys. Also probably, hopefully, embarrassed and ashamed, particularly as they didn't look too great when they were filmed. So there's them. There's the guy who films it, who is her number one priority. The guy who films it and uploads it is the one who's caused the most harm. There's the guys, PR guys, who are getting these sort of games going where women are being treated really abominably. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's completely drunk. They're sort of spitting through straws and trying to hit their breasts on the, you know, and these are the sorts of games that do go on in Magaluf. So there's a whole lot of, you know, when I've had a lot of questions of people saying, oh, is this a warning to young girls? I would say the book is a warning to almost everyone else first, you know, that's involved in this. Most of the men, you know, and the bar owners and everything. But what also sort of struck me was that there's a whole room full of people. There's a whole bar, crowded bar full of people watching this happen. And no one says, you know what, goes up to her and says, hey, you know, how about we go out and get some air? Or says, you know, put your phones down. No one says anything. So it's that kind of bystander apathy that of people who are just kind of letting things happen, which obviously are not going to be a good idea in the long run. They really do cause a lot of harm to the person involved in the end.
I like that, the idea you've said that, you know, people immediately go to say, you know, is the idea of this novel a warning to young women? That's always the cry that goes up when, you know, like a sex tape or something goes, you know, like people are in relationships and they, you know, they might film themselves and then one of them releases it. I'm usually the man, obviously. And then, of course, everybody says, well, if you don't want that to happen, don't do it. But, of course, you know, the person that's responsible for this is always the person that, that releases it.
Yeah, and I was thinking a lot about the taking of photographs and, you know, people, and I think the younger generation, it's almost a fifth base now. You know, you've got that, you've got, you know, what is it? It's kissing above the waist, below the waist.
I've never really understood the base system. Not having baseball in this country.
And the photo shoot, though, you know, the photo that comes out. And in the sort of throes of passion, when you really feel like connected with someone and that you really trust them, you must, because here you are having an amazing time together. You know, it's almost like it's a very difficult for young people and for anyone to grab for the condom when they should, but it's also difficult to say, oh, you know, let's not do that, you know. Because once it's done, you don't know that person really. You don't know what the relationship is going to be like when you split up or when you're not together anymore.
Obviously the media play a part in this as well. As you talk in this novel, the incident goes on and obviously it becomes a news story and therefore the papers are also, it's not just something that's being shared on social media, but, you know, they're writing about it in The Guardian in the book. So what sort of part do you think the media play in it?
Well, I think, I mean, I'd probably have to go back and look about over the reality of certain cases, actually. But, I mean, in the case of Viral, she's a sheriff and this girl is going off to medical school. And so it's reported as a big scandal because it's a sheriff's daughter.
Sure.
So, you know, how can she be commanding respect and justice when her daughter is this, you know, is that person? So, I mean, I don't know. I think the huge responsibility, I think it's probably just as bad, to be honest. And it's reporting what is actually happening and what people are thinking. And in terms of, like, rape stories, and you know, as they have been reported over the past, it's not very different from that, is it, in the way that it's portraying the fault of the girl, what she drank, what she wore, and all that sort of stuff.
I'm Jeff Dyer. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's talk about the characters in the book, then, which we obviously haven't done yet. Again, we've been talking about this incident and sort of comparing it to the similar things in real life. But let's actually get to know the people that you've created in the book. So Sue and Lee, who are the two sisters. Tell us who they are.
The family dynamic, I was saying earlier, I always like to find an interesting family dynamic. And the idea for this particular family came years and years ago when I was working in a cafe in Melbourne when I was at uni. And there was a gynecologist's office above the cafe. And a woman came in one day, a white woman with a beautiful black baby, who she'd adopted, I'm not sure from where, but we were all besotted as she was, that she was heavily pregnant. So she'd adopted after years of trying to conceive and being unable to, had adopted a baby from overseas, and then suddenly, miraculously, sort of without expecting it, obviously, fell pregnant. The next time I saw this woman, she was on the news because social services had taken the baby away, which is what happens in this story here. And that had stayed with me for years, and she was fighting obviously to get this baby back. Social services were saying at the time that there was no way that she would cope with two children so close in age, especially when you've got issues of cultural identity and everything, and adoption, which you need obviously, and it's true, you know, particular care and attention when you're bonding with the baby and so forth. So I don't know whether she ever got that baby back, you know, and I always wondered about her and always thought, well, if she did, that's an interesting little unit, you know, that she has got two daughters or children around the same age who are, you know, completely different places and have different ethnic identities and different cultural identities and different skin.
And in the story, there's tension between the girls as there wasn't before, but there is now as they're, you know, in their teenagers.
Yeah, and I just think that's normal. Yeah. Two girls of that age, you know, and they just fight. I mean, I always kind of, in probably all of my books, make out relationships at the start to be really, really awful. But actually, when I get to the end of the book, you realise, oh, that's actually probably just kind of quite normal for teenage girls. You know, Sue was a SWAT. She was studying really hard. And it's also, I've got two kids myself, and a lot of people say this, that the second one will kind of tend to do exactly the opposite of what the first one did. So Sue's very well behaved. But it's also about how Ruth's mother had to fight for Sue. And, you know, so she spent, 9 months of pregnancy with Leah. She spent that fighting to get Sue back and has been ever since just overly protective of her and probably a little bit neglectful of her biological daughter, which I thought was also a sort of different take. You might expect the opposite, but actually she's almost favoured Sue all her life because of that fear of losing her and that fear of being criticised for not being a good mother to her.
So let's talk about Ruth and Bernie then as well. Let's introduce them.
Yeah, so Ruth is, they met while she was travelling in America. He is from Portland and is in an orchestra. I don't know why I picked that. I've got an Uncle Bernie, and my Uncle Bernie I used to go and stay with on holidays, and he is the kindest, loveliest man, and actually reminds me of my husband as well. The nice guys in my books, that's who I think of, you know, usually my husband or Uncle Bernie. Although my husband says that I always write the serial killers as him. That's not true, I don't think. So she's a formidable woman. You know, I've met sheriffs in Scotland, you know, and a few women, and I've been in the courts a lot with my job, and I've sort of met characters like her where she's scary, you know, and very, very powerful, whereas he's very gentle, and I thought music was and calming and is very supportive to her career. So, but they're absolutely and completely in love. You know, that it works for them, their relationship.
And, I mean, there's always been a tension there between them two about this idea that Ruth might favour Sue over Lee, but then obviously once the incident happened, Sue goes missing, that's obviously intensified.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, well, he's always the voice of reason the whole way through their lives, really, and knows that it's a great partner, someone who, what could possibly be seen as your worst characteristics, actually, he gets that, you know, she's a fighter, she'll fight for things, and she's always done that. And so he gets that, but tries to moderate, you know, so he's always there with, you know, sort of calm her down and hang on, but are you doing the right thing here? But I don't think that the arguments they have actually are very different from, well, arguments that I would have with my partner, you know, if you seem to be, but hang on, you did, at that age, you were doing this with that one, and, you know, you're constantly sort of readjusting or rethinking how you're doing your parenting, you know, with one that, you know, because you've become more experienced, you've become probably more relaxed, and all of that stuff with the second one.
I mean, you've already touched on this a little bit, but we should talk about one of the themes of the book is the idea of the difficulties of adopting somebody from another culture as well. So is that something you particularly wanted to
Yeah, but I was about? Really nervous about doing it because I just know that I'm not an expert on it. And it's a difficult... I think at the time when I was talking about the Australian woman, it was very high on the agenda that social work was saying it's not a good idea to do this, you know. My personal feelings are difficult because my brother has adopted from overseas, and I know that he's a great parent, and that they've also had a lot of work to do to make sure that she feels that she knows her culture, and they're going back all the time. It's something I wouldn't do, but I mean, I don't want to, as you can tell with me stuttering, I find it a really difficult thing to talk about because I'm not comfortable with it enough, I suppose. But that's why I want to write about it, because I think that's how Ruth felt, you know, that they just sort of, you just sort of do something when you're desperate for a baby, and then you don't realise actually all of the issues that it might involve and all the areas that might sort of come up as a result of it through this child's life. I did do a lot of going onto forums and so forth, and listening to people who'd been adopted from South Korea, and watched a great documentary about twins. One had been adopted to America and one, I can't remember where they were, the other side of the world, and then they kind of found each other. And it was just really interesting listening to what people were saying. I think adoption fascinates me because I think it's always there. It does make you a different, your experience of life different, your experience of your family different. The uncomfortableness I'm feeling and through that book is why I wanted to write about it, I suppose.
The scenes set in Magaluf, I thought they're particularly vivid. How well researched were they?
Well, I didn't go over there, but my daughter helped me. I dedicated this book to her because she helped me with... there's all sorts of little details in there, and I was, being the parent who was panicking, constantly in touch with her the whole time. So there's little details like the MAGA Club Pass and Looky Looky Guys and the Chicken Nuggets. They call the girls white trash, I think it's meant to mean. And all sorts of little details like that, and also their daily schedule, which are just, you know, and the packing of 12 bikinis, you know, a bikini
all of those
day.
Rules that Lee had that Sue had to abide by, just amazing.
I know, that she gave to Sue, yeah. Well, I think she was meaning to be a good sister. Yeah. I mean, Sue has had a pretty boring life. She's just been studying the whole time. And Leah's like, oh, come on, you know, this is your chance. And, you know, one of the big things was, you've got to lose your virginity. You know, let's go, MAGA, Loof, let's get you a man there. So by the end of the 2 weeks there, this has become, and there's a real peer pressure thing. This is really built up, and almost the whole resort has heard about this girl who wants to lose her virginity. So it sort of added to the whole, to why it happened, you know.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Helen Fitzgerald, and we're talking about her novel Viral. Helen, before we broke up in the first part, I was quite surprised when you said about, we were talking about the adoption from another culture, and you were saying about, you know, how nervous you were about writing about that. Because in your day job, you're a social worker, and so I assumed that this was something you would have come across quite a lot at work. Of course, you're a criminal justice social worker, of course. So let's talk about what that is.
A criminal justice social
worker. Yeah.
It's probation service. In Scotland, social work is still run, probation. I don't know whether they used to here, actually, but it's always been a part of social work. So in my office, there's the criminal justice social workers. In my office, there's about 10 of us. We supervise people who are on parole and probation, supervise release orders, lifers, things like that. And we also do background and sentencing reports for the court, which are sort of mini biographies, which I love doing. But in our office, we also do have the adoption and fostering team and the child protection team and downstairs the adult services team. So I've talked to colleagues in probation in England, and they're quite jealous of that we still have that, because it's a nice value base, and also the communication between the teams, because they're all usually quite often quite interrelated, you know, in different teams, and we know a lot about each other's clients, and it's very, very helpful. So, you know, it would be easy for me if I wanted to move to child protection, I could. You know, my qualification is in social work, but I will never, ever do that. Criminal justice is nice and clear, you know, we have rules, we follow what the court tell us to do. It's not everyone hates me. I think when you're in child protection, everyone hates you. I really enjoy the job.
It's interesting, there's a moment that made me laugh when Ruth, when they go to visit the guy who they think, who's been released from prison, who they think might be involved, and he mentions his social worker, and she sort of says, yeah, I sort of shared the sort of distaste for the methods of his social worker, which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah, a lot of sheriffs really can't stand social workers, and they sort of tell, you know, I did an event the other day, actually, the one where I had a coughing fit as well, but there was a sheriff in the audience, and the bit I read out from Viral was the bit with Ruth, where she's in the court, and it's just come out all over the papers the day before, and she's decided, I've got to keep my sort of power, and I've got to keep my cool. She goes into work, and people are all laughing about it and making comments, and she realises, I can't keep doing this job just now, you know, I have to take some leave. But he came up to me afterwards and said, oh my God, social work, I mean, the words that you use, what's a criminogenic need, you know? And so they, yeah. Her views are sort of mirrored from a few sheriffs who I know, who sort of mock us a bit for our jargon and our touchy-feely sort of attitude.
Again, that work, you write about crime, that work, you know, inevitably must influence what you write about. But I mean, I guess also it's it's a difficult line to tread. You know, you obviously have to, you obviously can't reveal too much about the actual people that you're working with.
And I don't think I've ever actually revealed anything about any of them, which really surprises me. I could have, especially because I left for about 4 years and I could have then, but I've never done that. And it's not at the time when I wasn't working. I just wouldn't do that to anyone, actually. But I think more what it is, because I found some writing that I did when I was 18 and or around about then, or in my early 20s, you know, a whole bunch of short stories and poems, which were really bad. But it was the same. I was writing the same stuff and the same kind of, exactly the same tone, exactly the same black humour about someone who's committing a crime and the victim. So I mean, it obviously influences me. It keeps my mind alive. I love hearing the stories that I hear, and I love the job. And when I left, I felt really bored, so I wanted to go back. But and also things like the court scenes. You know, I know how the I know how it goes, and I know how psychology reports read. I know, So that, all of that is very helpful. But I've never used anyone in particular.
Well, you mentioned the courts. I was going to say, I mean, obviously in the first part we talked about the idea of the viral incident came from, you know, researching things that had already happened. The idea for the, you know, the woman who was adopting the child, it was an incident you saw. But like, what other parts of viral would you identify as being, you know, directly influenced by the day job?
By the day job, well, probably the court scenes mostly, and that was just the language and the way that the lawyers interact to the Silver Fox guy. I haven't met, I mean, he's not a person, but he's a kind of composite of lawyers that I've seen in action, and it's very rare that you see entertaining lawyers in court, but occasionally when you get one, it's like, wow. In fact, I need to just go into court more often and just sit there, and I encourage everybody to do that. It's fascinating.
I must admit, as soon as he appeared in the book, I immediately started picturing George Clooney in my head, and then, of course, he appeared. We talked briefly in the first part about the idea of, like, you know, how what has happened to Sue is not technically against the law, although things are changing, and hopefully things will change more so. And this is obviously something that Ruth is astonished by and sort of upset by. And, you know, the novel goes in a, you know, in an interesting direction in regards to that. But I mean, what do you think should be? Where should we go with that?
Well, I think that, like we were saying before, that there must be an acknowledgement that somebody filming and uploading something like that and it is intending to cause harm. And okay, it's not, they didn't know, you might not know the person, that might not be a revenge element, but surely that could be argued, isn't it? Just a small step away from the revenge pornography. So, yeah, I think it should be. And I don't know how many cases there are and how many people have come forward with similar things or tried to take stuff like that to court, but I can imagine that we'll have more and more of it, actually. And I think it is just a small step away.
Again, we talked about the sort of the encroachment of social media and how that's changed things, but going back to your day job, how have you seen that change in terms of not necessarily this same sort of incident happening, but how has just the idea... There's another, you know, scene in the book where Ruth accuses somebody of contempt of court because they're posting something to Facebook in the court and that, you know, How often does this happen?
Oh, that happens all the time. Yeah, you get told off for, in terms of my work and changes, I think in criminal justice, you know, we're seeing a lot of internet offenders. You know, it's just a huge number. And we're having huge issues with how to monitor and police that, you know. How can you, huge safety agreements and contracts that you draw up about, I'm not supposed to talk, I suppose it's all right to talk about the logistics of the job, I won't get in trouble, but, you know, we check devices and we're not very, well, skilled at that.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go around, I mean, I don't even know how to check my own, really, you know. So suddenly we've been told you have to go around and check phones and smart televisions and all sorts of things, and it's almost, I think we're going to need a lot more training than
I mean, the pace of change as well, this stuff has happened so quickly.
That's
the
so
technology
fast
changes,
and the reality is, can you stop anyone using the internet? I mean, how's anyone, it's not a good idea for anyone to not have a job, you know, if they are particularly motivated to work, or even if they're not, you know, a job is a good idea. What job can you actually do nowadays without requiring the use of a computer? There's a lot of questions and issues that are coming up because of all the internet offences that are happening. Yeah.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I'm going to ask you to read a bit from Viral, if you would.
Okay. I will. I'll read. I haven't practiced this, so please forgive me if it. And it's kind of towards the end. Suze, who's been hiding for about a week, I think, or several days anyway, is on a bike near Barcelona. And as we've talked about it, she was adopted from South Korea, and she's never tried to look for her biological mother. But this period of hiding, when she's completely on her own, she starts questioning who she is, which I think is the whole point of the book, mm-hmm. you know. And the whole point about public shaming is mm-hmm. about, is this now what defines me? Who am I? So a natural story for this was that eventually she would be asking the question about her roots. So she's on a bike. Okay. After 10 minutes on the road and several on the gravel, avoiding scary lorries with flashing lights and beeping horns, a sign says it's 9 kilometres to Barcelona. I stop, irritated, because I thought I was heading away from civilization, not back into it. But then I notice that there's a picture of an aeroplane on the list of destinations. I stare at the wee plane and wonder if the supernatural exists for the first time since Michael O'Hare's mother's statue of the Madonna winked at me. Perhaps this is a sign, not a sign. I continue in the same direction because I have just made a snap and inspired decision. I'd planned to hide out a while longer. I'd hoped that time would dilute my desire to hurt the man who filmed me, that time and space would stop me disappointing Mum all over again by breaking the law, by breaking his neck, by slitting his throat, by poisoning him with drain cleaner. The picture of the aeroplane has cleared my head. I'm going to the airport. This is the perfect and possibly the only time. I'll call them once I land in Seoul. I'll explain that some good has come out of all this. I'll be assertive and tell them this is something I've needed to do for a long time. I think they might understand now. I think they'll be relieved that I'm out of sight for a while. The plan gathers detail as I gain speed. When I arrive, I'll buy a smart trouser suit and I'll book into a hotel and I'll scrub myself clean. I'll go and visit retired officer Moon Ji-hoo and I'll pay him to tell me what he knows. Then I'll go to the squat my mother smokes crystal metamorphine in, or to the street she begs on, or to the dark alley where she grasps her near-empty bottle of soju, or to the prison or mental institution where she repeatedly cuts at a designated portion of her upper left thigh. I'll go to her and I'll tell her who I am. She won't have seen the sex tape, no way. She probably doesn't even have the internet. A fine notion, in fact. People existed without the internet for centuries and survived. Poor people, like my birth mother, still do. I, too, can live without it. I decide to declare it out loud. I hereby swear that I will never go online again. The oath brings on the desire to make others, which I yell as I pedal. I hereby swear that I will never go to Magaluf again. I hereby swear that I will never perform sex acts in public again. And I stop at the side of the road, take out the 2 bottles of sangria I bought at the village shop, and toss them over the fence into a field. I hereby swear that I will never drink or take anything that results in the handing over of my faculties ever again. Pedaling faster now, due to the onset of an unparalleled excitement, and perhaps because I'm mine is the weight of the wine, I picture my birth mother's face when I tell her who I am. It'll crumple, and then she'll spurt tears of agonized guilt. I feel I can actually see her, not her face exactly, but the shape of her and her response. She's begging for my forgiveness. She's saying she knows it's no excuse, and she doesn't deserve or expect me to forgive her, but she had no choice, you see. You are so beautiful. Because she was destitute and still is, doesn't even have the internet, and she was all alone with no family and still is. And she had and still has at least 2 other serious health problems that make motherhood impossible. She's blind and a paraplegic, for instance. After she's said all this and is on her knees with her hands pressed together as if in prayer, I will look down on her with Dalai Lama serenity, and this is what I will say. I forgive you. Her tears of guilt will recede and pride will surface. Her face will redden and her heartbeat will quicken. She'll manage to stand and start talking with speed, confidence, but mostly gratitude. You forgive me? Really? Su Jin, you are good, so good, and I am not, because I put you in a basket and I abandoned you. I should have fought for you, but I couldn't for so many excellent reasons, like the paraplegia. Oh, I need to edit the scene, because she wouldn't be able to kneel or stand up. For so many excellent reasons, like the blindness. Oh, she wouldn't have said you're so beautiful, because she wouldn't have been able to see me. Reasons like the leprosy. Su Jin, you grew inside me, inside this hopeless and undernourished outcast. She put her hands on my shoulders. It's a myth that it's contagious, just prejudice. But I see you know that already, because you are highly educated, exceptionally clever, and know everything there is to know about all the medical conditions in the universe. and she'll stretch her arms straight to hold me there and absorb from a comfortable distance, because she simply cannot get over that the incredible woman standing in front of her is Su Jin. I go by Sue, I'll say, and she'll ask if she can use the gin, and I'll say no, because I make my own decisions, me, and I'm Sue. I'm Sue of 48 hours ago. Sue is one who's 100% sane, not even 0.015% crazy, who's respectful and purposeful, and who will study medicine somewhere more prestigious than Edinburgh, and who'll go on to win a Nobel Prize for curing something highly horrible, but not leprosy, because someone did that already. And you will have the treatment now that I've found you, birth mother. I will take you to the hospital immediately, and I will pay Western money to rid you of this affliction, which, strangely and thankfully, has caused no scabby lesions that I can see. Where was I? I'm the Sue who's going to win the Nobel Prize for curing dementia. So when you start forgetting things you would never ever forget, like where you left the soju, I'm the Sue who won the prize for discovering the meds that mean you can remember where it is. It's in the garage at the side of your villa, otherwise known as the side pocket of your walk and rest tri-wheel shopping trolley. I'm smiling. Haven't done that for a while. My success will ease the suffering my birth mother has endured due to poverty, homelessness, mental illness, addiction, delete as appropriate, because I am proof that her genes are from Waitrose. It's just her luck that's co-op. I can't stop smiling. Comforting her will comfort me. Easing her guilt will restore my virtue. Airport, 5 kilometres. This is happening at last. I'm on my way.
I've been talking to Helen Fitzgerald. We've been talking about her novel Viral, which is out now from Faber. So, Helen, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Caitlin Doty. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archives at littleatoms.com.
Francesca Kay's first novel, An Equal Stillness, won the Orange Award for New Writers and was nominated for the Authors Club First Novel Award and for Best First Book in the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Her second novel, The Translation of Bones, was long listed for the Orange Prize for Fiction. And her third novel, The Long Room, we're going to be talking about today. So, Francesca, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Real pleasure.
So tell me in your words how you describe The Long Room, what it's about.
The Long Room is essentially the story of a rather isolated young man whose job is to listen to other people's conversations and who spends a great deal of time with his head in the clouds, in a sense, eventually finding, but in the loneliness and isolation that he feels, eventually drives him to a course of action which is really disastrous for him, and brings about a catastrophic result.
Let's talk about the setting. So it's 1981. The novel is set, so it's the Cold War, I guess, is just sort of starting hotting up. Reagan and Thatcher are in power, and the IRA is still operating around London. This is the Falklands War is sort of on the horizon. Let's talk about that time, because we're obviously like quite a distance from that now.
Yes, for some of us it's not exactly ancient history, but for a lot of people it is extremely remote. It might as well be that it is a remote period of history. I thought, though, that it does have certain resonances for us today, and I, especially in the sense that unexplained anxiety that lurked in the background all the time, which I think many of us who were alive then sort of remember, which was to do with that sense that the world was a very dangerous place. I think we have that feeling again now. So, or perhaps we've never lost it, but it's very acute at the moment. So there are things about that time just on the cusp of the Falkland War, when things were changing very fast in British society, which have certain parallels with the modern world. I wouldn't want to overlabor them. The novel is partly set in that period because it just interested me to go back and think about it. A very different time, a very different culture, but also particularly a time long before anybody thought about computers or personal computers or computers used for surveillance. And so the story, which is set in a sort of fictional, rather shady kind of espionage setting, would not have worked if it had been a modern setting with all the kinds of devices that must now exist.
And not just computers in terms of their use in sort of mass surveillance now, but you do mention early on in the book about the expense of phone calls. This is a time before mobile communications, before text messages and things, where people, you know, communicate online very cheaply, like we're doing now on Skype. And so people's use of telephones was much more circumspect.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's very difficult, even though, I mean, I was a young adult at the time, but to try to recover some of the feeling of that, the details of that time, is quite difficult, because things that we have completely forgotten, like the way that people used to say, we can't talk now because it's costing too much, or wait until, you know, only after 8 o'clock could you possibly manage to call your friends. It is an extraordinarily different world, and yet it is only, you know, 35 years ago, a little bit less than that. It is extraordinary, the rate of change.
So we've set what the time of the novel is, so it's in a definite time and a definite place. We'll talk about what The Long Room is in a moment, where it's sort of mainly set, but there's also this feeling to me of almost like a timelessness, because it's set in this bureaucratic building, which is sort of redolent of things from like Kafka, but then right up to like films that were around at that time in the early 80s, like Brazil, for instance, and Orwell and stuff. I mean, was that deliberate?
Yes, it was. It was. Although I set it very specifically in that year, and pretty much in the last 2 weeks of the year, 1981, that was a structural device, really, because I think that the probably, you know, offices hadn't really changed. They probably were much like that during the, you know, immediately after the war, that kind of slightly grey, slightly drab sense of a city that was kind of closing on itself during winter. And where the sort of tedious details of life, that probably hadn't changed. And yes, certainly I did have in mind the people who have written so incredibly well about that before.
And, I mean, funnily enough, we should just say that it's set literally now, like a couple of weeks before Christmas, isn't it? Which is a coincidence to when we're recording it. But this is exactly when we're talking, a couple of weeks before Christmas.
Yes, it is precisely that. Where, so although some people are, the protagonist is worried about life and love, and but other people are worried about whether they've bought sellotape, or which is actually probably true for most of us right now.
Or whether they're not going to be able to get out and get Christmas presents on their lunch hour.
Yes. I mean, I think that that of course, I find that fascinating, that the big drama of life always goes on against lots and lots of little dramas. Whatever that one's personal drama is, other people's drama is just as important to them at the time, and they carry on, and they're no less important in a sense. Although I try, you know, I make them, I hope, slightly comic. You know, anxieties about how you fit the turkey into the two small fridges and so on. But that the texture of daily life is part of the novel, I hope.
Let's talk about the Institute then, which is the place where all this is taking place. It's right there that there's quite an anonymous name for it. I mean, you don't sort of describe it as being as belonging to any, you know, real life agency that we would know, MI5 or MI6 or whatever. It's just, again, this anonymous bureaucratic place.
Yes, I didn't think about it in any kind of specific terms. Wasn't particularly interested in the sort of minutia, the business of espionage or spying. I'm interested in that shadowy world, which is a fictional world, the fictional world, like, you know, Spyland, most famously and probably best mapped out by Le Carré, but lots of other people too, Graham Greene or earlier Conrad, that sort of twilight land, which nobody quite knows what's going on, most memorably and brilliantly summed up in T.S. Eliot's phrase, which has been borrowed by many other people since, of a wilderness of mirrors. That's what interested me, and that's the perfect setting for somebody who doesn't really know where he is, a setting where he isn't sure, nobody knows what anybody's doing, nobody really knows what the truth is, and nobody knows who they can trust. It's a very isolating place.
I was going to ask you about other literary influences, and obviously this is more Le Carré than it is Ian Fleming, but it is interesting, again, even though we're talking about this being set 35 years in the past, 1981, the feeling that comes from the novel of those sort of Le Carré novels and the Graham Greene almost means it could be set really at any time between the sort of post-war period. You know, it could be one of those, like The Third Man or something, or any of those sort of novels set in Berlin after, you know, during the Cold War. It has that same feeling. It's interesting to sort of think about actually how little the world changed. The world has changed so much more in the next 35 years than it did then. It felt like the world was very similar in 81 than what it would have been in, like, 61.
I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're absolutely right. The pace of change has just been absolutely extraordinarily speeded up in the last 30 years. So yes, it could have been set at any of those periods. I've read Le Carré with much admiration, but I wasn't really thinking about the great writers of spy fiction when I wrote the novel. I was just much more interested in a character under pressure, and that seemed to be a very good setting for that character. But it is probably for exactly the same reasons that so many other people have used it, that land, that spy land, as I call it.
I mean, you mentioned earlier as well that you're not so bothered about the sort of minutiae of the sort of spying, the equipment, the techniques, but you do go into, you do cover that, and it does seem very, very authentic. So let's perhaps talk about research you did. I know your earlier novels were like quite densely researched, so how did that go for this one?
Well, I did really make it up. I mean, it just seemed too difficult to find out what might really have happened, and it's so long ago. And whatever techniques there might have been then certainly wouldn't be the same techniques now. So I made up the whole in the details, which I hope sound very convincing, about the lengths of tapes and the way that people do things and how they change their tapes around, is entirely invented, entirely imaginary. But it is as specific there, because the shadowy spyland is also marked by certain kinds of specific detail, as any setting is. And so the detail is there to make it convincing, details about, say, notice boards and instructions from security and what you can't and can't do and so on. But that, you know, that's the fun of fiction, isn't it, making it all up?
No, absolutely. But it is incredibly convincing, most definitely.
Good. Good. Well, I mean, that's a lovely thing to hear, because I feel that is, you know, that's halfway to, I mean, that is the best thing that any writer can be told, that the reader can believe in that world, at least for a little while.
I do think in some respects that sort of reliance on the, especially when it's used, like for somebody like Ian McEwan or somebody who I love, but how the way that his novels are so well researched for ages, he's almost put out as part of the, you know, as part of the publicity for them, when it's fiction and it doesn't matter if you make it all up.
I think, I mean, you said my previous novels were heavily researched. Well, that's nice to think that that's how they come across, but it's not really the case. Although I did, in the first novel, which is all about painting, I researched specifically techniques, because I had no idea before I started how one might fresco a wall. And it was really, really interesting to learn about the actual nitty-gritty of painting techniques, brushes and turpentine and all those sorts of things which one can read about. So that I found that fascinating, and I had been anyway interested in the art of that period, so I read a lot more around it. But research isn't really perhaps my strongest point. I think it is good to check the certain facts are accurate, because no reader can believe the rest of the story if they can see a glaringly, obviously inconsistent untruth. But much more is the product of invention than the product of assiduous research.
I'm Jonathan Meads, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's spend some time talking about Stephen, then, who's the protagonist. Now, I've said we're obviously not going to give, this is a, you know, it's a thriller, we don't want to give away what happens at the ending, but let's perhaps talk about Stephen, who he is, and I guess some of his background.
Stephen is young, but rather old, rather elderly young man. He's only 28. He's clever, but he's a bit of a dreamer. He's the sort of person who has read a very great deal of poetry, but not really seen a very great deal of life. He does have aspirations to see more of life. He has ambitions. Crucially, he really wants to be loved. So when he is recruited into the Institute, he sees this as an opportunity after a rather undistinguished university career and a sort of school background where he would have been possibly top of the form in exams, but certainly not in levels of popularity or being the captain of the hockey team or any of those other things. So he feels that he is ready for the kind of excitement in life that he believes he deserves. But life in the Institute is so boring, and he is so isolated that his sort of sense of poetry and his sense of himself and so on are very much sapped by what his life is. So what goes wrong for him is his attempt to change that.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite funny at the beginning, that contrast between the excitement he was expecting in a life of working in espionage and the actual mundane reality.
Yes, I mean, when he has to spend half his time having his colleagues saying who's going to make sausage rolls for the Christmas party, whereas he still he believed that he was going to be more James Bond than the sadder characters that you were talking about earlier. That's what he was rather hoping for, and what he got was a big disappointment to him.
And then his mother, Coralie, is also a character in the novel and gives us a sort of a backstory for Stephen as well. So how much could we talk about a little bit about that?
Well, Coralie, I loved Coralie. Coralie just seemed to me that somebody who was practically dictating her own story into my ear, because her voice seemed very clear. She's there partly because she gives another dimension, another human dimension to the novel, but also through her I wanted to be able to convey Stephen's own past through her, her account of the things that have happened, not in a great deal of detail, but the fact that she's a single mother, and they lived a rather sort of straitened and possibly rather solitary life, the two of them. She's not very good at expressing her emotions, although she certainly loves him and he loves her, but neither of them has probably ever said that.
And then we haven't mentioned the object of Stephen's love, really, in the description at the beginning, although it's not giving too much away, because it is in the blurb of the book. So Helen, who is the wife of one of the targets of the Institute. So Stephen is monitoring somebody and he basically falls for his wife. So tell us something about that situation.
Yes, I mean, he's excited when he gets given this particular case because it looks like, and it could be a very exciting case, it looks as though he might be being asked to help with the investigation of a traitor. I don't keep thrilled by that, but in fact, the case itself just produces nothing while he's listening to it, except for the fact that he hears much more of the target's wife than he hears of the target himself, and the target's wife completely captivates him. She captivates him with her voice, by her singing, by her piano playing, and this man who is just hungry for love falls for her, although he has no idea what she looks like. But of course, he invents as the novel goes on, or as the novel begins and as it continues, he invents her character very convincingly to himself. And among the things that he is convinced of is that she's very unhappy and she is trapped in a marriage that he is sure is, if not actually violent, at least potentially damaging to her. And he feels that it will be his role to rescue her. He's basically crazily in love with her.
And so there's two parallel ideas here. So you've got this Stephen an ironic look at quite a common trait, which is this idea of a man who feels that he needs to rescue a woman from a situation. But also the other layer of that, the sort of ironic layer of that is he's like this, sort of morally compromised guy who's basically only knows about it because he's spying on them. So he's no hero.
Yeah, well, you've exactly got it. It's a world full of paradoxes, isn't it? You've exactly hit it. I mean, he's no hero in a sense, although his motives, as they relate to the woman, are pure at heart. He's not a creepy stalker, but he is, of course, he has deceived himself in a very serious way with this. But nonetheless, it is love. He is in love, and love is not always a question of being reciprocated or even being clear-sighted, is it? So he has fallen in love, essentially with a voice. And we all know really quite how important a voice can be in terms of giving a sense of what a person is like. You only need to just be talking to somebody on the radio or on a telephone call. You get a sense of that person, don't you, which may be completely different from the actual reality. And in his case, he's very easily going to fall over the borderline between just enjoying the sound of her and feeling that somehow there's some message that she conveys to him through what she sounds like.
It's interesting that you say he's not a creepy stalker, because although on one level that's true, I mean, he's officially sanctioned creepy stalker. He's about as creepy a stalker as you can imagine, I think.
Did you think so? I hope you didn't think he was too creepy, because he's not, of course...
No, not himself, and I mean the situation that he finds himself in, because he's implicitly, professionally a creepy stalker.
Oh, the situation, yes, yes. Yes, of course he is, of course he is, of course he is. But I mean, he's not necessarily, for the purposes of the novel, examining the motivation all around him. This is the job that they're all doing, and they're just doing it. We, the readers, can make our own minds up about the amorality of it, the amorality of the whole situation. But in his pursuit of the woman that he's in love with, he certainly wouldn't harm her or in that sense, I mean, he's not a creepy stalker, at least, of her.
I think that's an interesting contrast to the theme of the book, though, in that his lack of awareness and also his lack of sort of concern about the amorality of the job put up against, again, as I said, his sort of like almost entitled belief that he should be doing something to sort of save her, I think. Those two things rub up against each other.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes, I mean, there are moments in which he wonders about the morality of his job. I mean, he becomes, she, the wife of the target, is not the only person he is compelled to listen to. And the other people that he listens to are, in a sense, also becoming his friends. He's in love with one of them, but he's not with her, but the others, he's tipping over the edge of being professional. And becoming more involved, say, in one particular old man's ill health. So there's an implicit comment there, isn't there? These people should not be being listened to. They have nothing of any interest to say. So he doesn't bother to report anything that they say. Because he knows that it's a pointless exercise from that point of view. But he continues to listen to the details of their lives because he's fond of them. That's not to say that this is a morally justifiable position, but it's the amoral world in which they're.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.